Wait. Okay, so I think, like Venerable Sean's idea, which is Buddhism from A to Z, to really go from A to Z, I mean, you can also learn the alphabet by, you know, going backwards and forwards and then the middle and this and that, but there is a structure, there is an order, and this order and this structure is made for us to make it easier. Yeah. So there's a few texts that have almost the same structure, and they're actually present in all the Tibetan traditions. Like for the Kagyus, it's Kampopa's Jewel Ornament of Liberation. For the Gelugs, it's especially Lama Tsongkhapa's what is called Lam Rim, the Graduated Path to Enlightenment. There's also, if you look in the Nyingma tradition, they call this something like the preparatory practices, because they do a lot of like religious things also, like prostrations and mandala offerings and water bowls and taking refuge like 100,000 times, like this, you know, they have this what is called the preparatory practices. So the four thoughts there, before you do these strange things, if you're not used to them, is you think about precious human rebirth, you think about impermanent and death, you think about karma, you think about refuge, then you think about suffering and samsara, right? So these are, this is what we have to make our mind very familiar with, okay? So I think this one with the refuge, I'll base it on the Lam Rim because this is what I'm used to. But you can find it in any other tradition. And actually the refuge comes quite early in your practice. Right, it's part of the lower scope, because in order to take refuge, are you okay? You, the two of you, there, yeah, fine. Okay, so, yeah, just communicate with each other if you need to communicate. It's fine. So it comes in the lower scope, and if you really take, they always talk about this heartfelt refuge, right? So that's when you have fear of something. Now, we don't like the word fear because we don't want to be motivated by fear. But please, you know, there are things that are, it's useful fear, because if we're not afraid of going into the jungle and the jungle is full of snakes and tigers and we're very courageous, say, "Oh, I'm not afraid of these things." Well, you probably won't survive. So it's much better to be a little bit humble and say, well, you know, do I really need to go there? And I might get hurt. And if you can, then you maybe take some precautions and, you know, at least wear high boots or something like that, because there's snakes. Do you see what I mean? Yeah. So fear can be, I don't know, but the word fear is so heavy. Yeah, you can, if you want, you can exchange these words, right? For
cautious.
Yeah, cautious, okay. Whatever, you know. I think fear is good. We're always so afraid.
Guy Ponchuk, our Ponchuk, you know.
Ponchuk,
yeah.
He, last time he was in Israel, he told me, all I do is because I'm so afraid.
Yeah.
All this that I left to India and India,
yeah.
I'm so afraid, and I thought, wow, you know, he really feels the fear.
Fear can be a really good, a very good force if it's reasonable fear. So we don't have to make it nicer than it is. But, you know, especially, usually this, the topic of refuge, especially because I work a lot with beginners and introduction courses and all this, I never even mention it. Because it sounds a bit like you're going on a mission and you want everybody to become a Buddhist. You can only take refuge if you know what Buddhism is all about and you really know the path already, right? And somehow this Lama that was in my dream came and taught me that I was going to teach. He kind of knew it, you know? But without talking to him about it. He was living in Dharamsala for a while. He was very big and very wrathful also. I was actually a bit afraid of him. And so when he would, occasionally he would come to Tushita and, you know, do 1 or 2 days in these 10-day introduction courses. So I asked him to do compassion and wisdom, or wisdom, I think, because that's always what's the most complicated. And so we asked the lamas to do it because they study it backwards and forwards. And he looked at me and said, no, I'll teach refuge. I thought, oh, okay. So anyway, so I don't have the confidence to teach refuge to total beginners, because it sounds, one thing is like, you know, you have to use very old-fashioned words that people totally block, and it's not necessary for them to block. Whereas I think for us, if you really are interested in taking refuge and you started practicing, we can use these old-fashioned words, and we can really see what the text says, and then look at what kind of attitude do I have towards this, okay? So the way the Lamrim is built up is like, first, of course, you think about meditation and all these kind of things that is really necessary on the path, you know, like the Lamrim Chemo starts with talking about meditation. It's not only coming in the fifth perfection, like with the concentration. It talks about the different kinds of meditation at the beginning of the big Lamrim, the Lamrim Chemo. It's a very nice chapter, actually. Talks about a guru, you know, how we have to rely on a guru, which is, again, for somebody who is new, that, well, I don't want a guru. But these people are so valuable in our lives because they have the courage to tell us what we don't want to hear. You know, when Nissim said yesterday, if I start with my group about renunciation, nobody will come anymore. I wouldn't be so sure, I don't know, you know, because if we only do what we like to do, then how can we make progress? Or many leave, okay. I don't know, you know. So maybe it's worthwhile for the few who will stay, or maybe even for you alone, you know, to still think about these unpleasant things. Okay. So then the next topic is like thinking about precious human rebirths, and that also we don't do it enough. I think, again, if you are very familiar with these topics and you use them when you are depressed or when you're sad or when you're panicking, that's great, you know. Because these are the moments that we should use it. When you're well and everything goes well, it's like we don't really need the Dharma. Because when we're well and happy, we actually don't create negative karma. Yeah, we don't harm others. You all know that, but it's when we get frustrated and stressed and all this, then we start to, then the I becomes very big and we start to be concerned just about ourselves. So precious human rebirth, you know, if we really understand what this means, we have all the conditions together to attain liberation in this life. Not to attain liberation in this life maybe, but in this life that we have all the causes and the conditions that we can go on this path that we call the path to liberation. How can we be depressed? You know? It's like somebody having a Visa card who has unlimited credit and then says, but I want the MasterCard. You know? I want it better. So with the precious human rebirth also, it's not just that you have all the freedoms to do whatever you want, but you have the freedom that if you want to practice, you can practice. So you need to know these 8 freedoms and the 10 endowments that we can appreciate having them when we have them. So because whatever you appreciate makes you happy. Right? So we need to reflect on these things again and again and again and again until the mind is so familiar with them that even though there is some depression coming because, also physical fatigue, because it happened to me with the burnout. I'm quite happy that I had a burnout because now I know how it feels. You're totally useless. You cannot do anything about this whole thing. You have no confidence whatsoever, even though the whole world loves you. It's quite an interesting state of mind. It really is. And I think it really helped me to be able to think about these things. So it's not that the pressure on my chest lifted up or anything like that, you know. But I wasn't plunging into it so much. I knew it was impermanent, but that doesn't mean it makes it go away immediately. But then you don't stress about it. So I kind of totally relaxed into this very, very unpleasant state of mind, which we call burnout. And what was interesting to see also, the people around me, they tried to hide it. You know, when somebody said, why did the course get cancelled? Because when I heard it, I kind of just said, because I had a burnout, or I have a burnout while I was still in it. I was never afraid or ashamed to say it. It's kind of, you can also call it a deep depression. You feel like you're useless. You're afraid of everything. The mind produces a lot of problems, and the moment you solved one, the mind actually almost obsessively is searching for the next one that you can stress about. So Ines is nodding, so you must have been in the same...
Yeah, that's what my life looks like.
Your whole life? Okay. you wouldn't be smiling if it's a burnout, okay? You don't want to see anybody, you just want to withdraw, and this is why, you know, you guys very, very nicely and very kindly invited me to come to Israel. I said, why? You know, I'll take my mind with me, so I'd rather be somewhere where I feel comfortable, and that was in Bern, where I can just work with this also in a very relaxed way, because I'm familiar with the apartment. The apartment is kind of small. Marlies offered me her house in the mountains with 18 rooms or something like that. I said, I don't want 18 rooms. I'll start cleaning them. Thank you very much. I think I need some rest. So also to be able to just say, you know, that's it. And people say, what? You know, with your practice, you shouldn't. And I said, well, yes, it's true. I shouldn't get into these states, but I am in a state like this, so that's the way it is. So it was very interesting, yeah. And then, you know, meditation on precious human rebirth, it's kind of, because you still have the Dharma, you still know, okay, I'm in a very, very unpleasant state of mind. It's ripening of negative karma. I could also see why, because I was totally exhausting myself, running around Europe, having the flu, swallowing every medicine that people would give me so I can continue teaching, because I thought, well, now I'm in Paris, and, you know, I came here, so I might as well just do the... Just, you know, pushing, 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 pushing. Not really pushing, but doing. And then at one point, I just like a fuse, the blows, you know, I came back from Paris, I had 40 fever, I had a very bad cough, and I knew I came back on Monday, and on Wednesday I had to take another 12-hour journey train to Graz to teach there. And just the thought that I have to go into another train, which is air-conditioned and which is really bad for my cough, I panicked. I totally panicked. I picked up the phone, I cancelled the course. Because I said, look, I'm sorry. I could have said I have the flu, that's true. But I also added, and I'm incapable to teach because I have lost all self-confidence. I don't remember anything. You know, Gevan Geshe Tashi came, and I said that for Friday evening I would make his soup. I even panicked about this. And I can cook. I can cook. But I panicked about making a soup. So it took me about months to recover, which is very quick. Even the doctor said, wow, you know, what did he do? I roasted sesame seeds. I made like kilos and kilos of Comasio, which had to be done. And that was because you need therapy at that point. You can't just not do anything because I think because there's a lot of fear. And if I look at it, my biggest fear was, how do I spend the day? How do I pass the day? You know? Because even going for a walk, it was February, it was grey, it was cold, it was wet. So that suited my state of mind very well, which was kind of good. Because when you're depressed and in such a state, and in Switzerland when the weather is good, everybody thinks you should be happy. Because the weather is not good very often. Yeah. So when you say, well, I'm not so well, they say, but look at the weather. But it doesn't help. So it's much better, it's much more conducive, it's grey and dark and whatever. Then at least you can just be the way you are. You don't have to cheer up because of the sunshine. Here in Israel, there's no danger. Nobody would tell you, be happy because the sun is shining. Isn't it? Maybe you're not allowed to be depressed on a rainy day, or I don't know. Yeah. So like this. So we had these 50 kilos. It's a lot, like it's two bags from the floor, like this, you know, two 25-kilo bags of raw sesame seeds that needed to be roasted and made into gomasio, which is sesame salt, and then put into 100-gram bags. So that's 500 bags, okay?
This is what you sold in the...
Yeah, because we had this project to sell it with not so much profit, like for €5 each bag, and then to give the profit to the nuns in Tsum. It's a very remote valley in Nepal. If you've been to Kopan, the Tsum nuns are connected to Kopan. It's one of they take care of them somehow, sending teachers and... But, you know, they live in houses that look a bit like the house down here that is falling apart. They have, in their whole life, they never had a bed, for example. They sleep on the bare floor, mud floor, and some of them are quite old, some are younger. They would be great retreat places there, but they're all falling apart because also everybody moves out. So anyway, so our director, she went there and she's doing her PhD on that place. And so she came back, she told us about this, and we said, well, let's see if we can do some fundraising for the nuns. We're a small group, so we can't do like big, you know, so we did small sesame seed. But I saw these 50 kilos of unroasted sesame, and nobody had time to roast it. And I thought, you know, what a crazy idea, and who, you know, who is going to roast it? Who is going to buy it? I already saw, like, 500 bags of sesame seed coming back to the center and nobody bought it. And, you know, like everything is negative, isn't it? Everything, what you want to plan to do, it won't work. And then I thought, why don't you start? Nobody else has time. You're totally useless at the moment. So you start. I can't do this. I'll burn it. I've never done it. I don't know how to do it. And just start. So, of course, the first batch I burned. But it doesn't matter because then I knew... You know, you burn 200 grams for 50 kilos, no big deal. And so I knew how not to roast them. And then I started roasting them. And for 3 weeks, or maybe a month, every day for 5 hours, I was standing at the, you know, and like it, because you can only do very small quantities so that all of them get roasted and so that they're really good. After 1 week, I started looking forward to the day to do this. Because why? It was something that, other people were very happy that I was doing it. It smells really good in the apartment, the roasted seeds. It's healthy. It was for others, it wasn't for me. And it wasn't some stupid therapy like drawing or whatever that it's, you know, it's only for the sake of drawing and for the sake of feeling better. You know, so the shift went totally from doing something for the sake of feeling better, to do something that needs to be done. And it was easy. It's very repetitive, so after a while you know how to do it. After a few weeks, I was totally okay again. So like this. But the thought on precious human rebirth and, you know, karma, refuge, bodhicitta was very far away at that time, was still there. And it really helped, I think, to get over it. It's not instantaneous. But if it's at the back of your mind, and Tara mantras, Tara practice really helped to sometimes, occasionally, lift up that pressure is on your chest, you know. The funny thing is that about a month before, I had the opposite. I had, like, total high because I had a sudden loss of hearing on my ear. But, you know, you wake up one morning, you can't hear anymore. And so they say it's a bit like a heart attack. It would have been the first sign to stop, right? But I had full schedule, so it didn't stop. So, but I only could go to the doctor 5 days later because I was going to Graz the next day. So then the doctor said, well, it's a bit too late because you have to do something immediately. Then maybe the hearing comes back. So... But we can still try. If you want, I give you cortisone, and then you can, you know, the hearing might come back. So he gave me very strong doses of cortisone. I tell you, I was totally flying. I could have saved the whole world. Really, I had so much self-confidence. So it was, it's chemicals in the brain, you know. So you have this high and then schluck, and then you plunge, and then the plunging came, exhaustion, sickness, the flu, and all this. So it's perfectly explainable why I had the burnout, so it's fine, you know. It's causes and conditions. You create the causes for a burnout, and you're my age, and you don't stop when the signs come, then that's it. You know, I went to the doctor because of the flu, and he said, look, and I described what else was going on. He said, well, I'm not surprised. If I look at the schedule you have, this is, you know, you have a burnout. I like to hear that diagnosis, actually, because it gave me the permission to stop. I'm glad it wasn't cancer, because some people get cancer when they do these kind of things, you know, going and not stopping. So now, because of this, I still don't hear my left ear. I have a very strong tinnitus. Like last night, it went totally crazy. So the music was not disturbing whatsoever, because the ear was going, you know. And sometimes I get really dizzy. So if you see me going on a bit, going a bit like this, I'm not drunk, okay? I'm just dizzy. Sometimes I get nauseous, then I have to lie down. But for the moment, it's okay. For the moment, it's just a tinnitus, a bit of dizzy. So like that. So, precious human rebirths. If we get familiar with this, you know, then we think, okay, I'm stuck now, but still, I have all these other conditions and the possibilities to practice, to use the Dharma as tools when I'm not well. Yeah. Then the next topic is impermanence and death. So, wow, I'm still alive, because I don't know how long I will have it. And then the next topic that we hardly ever talk about, I think not even the teachers, what's the next topic after impermanence and death?
Karma.
Not really, not yet. No, that's how we present it, because otherwise everybody runs away. See, you don't even know it.
After impermanence and death, I thought karma.
No, you don't even have it there. The suffering of the lower states. That's the next topic. After what comes after death?
This is in the
Lamayim. Talks about it very.
Look in your liberation in the palm of your hand. A very vivid description of hell realms, hungry ghost realms, animal realms. These are the three realms. We kind of, you know, even on the advice of the lamas, we started leaving it out for Westerners, because it totally turns them away from the whole thing. They totally don't see the benefit anymore, because, I don't know, there's no English word for aufgeklärt. Yeah? There's a German word for Aufklärung or aufgeklärt. Like, maybe the last century was the century of, you speak German, yeah? Bit. Aufgeklärt. And aufgeklärt is you, it's not that you learn something, it's more that you change your views. Like, for example, if you take your children and you tell them that it's not the stork. The stork that is bringing the babies, this is the view in Europe, right? It's like, yeah, here as well.
Yeah.
And you tell them how babies are coming into existence, then this is the act of doing this is aufklären. Klären means clarifying. So the last century was the century of Aufklärung, that, you know, science, and we stop believing what the church is saying, and we know it all by ourselves. And even now, you know, with the Google and all this, it's like we know everything and we know it right. We're not believing in myth anymore, you know, like this. There's no German, there's no English word for that. That really explains what it is. Clarifying is not strong enough. Well informed is not strong enough. I looked it up on the leo.org, on a dictionary thing. There's no English word for that. Because it means really clarifying wrong views. Like, you know, like that.
What is the German
name? Aufklären. Or Aufklärung. Das Zeitalter der Aufklärung. When we stop believing in, you know. But you know, we're actually, if you look at science, they're constantly in the Zeitalter is an era. We're constantly in the era of Aufklärung, because science is constantly changing their views. And whenever the view is there, then we think that's it. That's the last one. You know, at one point the Earth was flat. At another point the Earth was... Now it's round. Who knows? What come? You know, one point then the Earth doesn't exist. That's what the Buddha says. The way it appears. Okay?
And we don't learn it when we learn the eight freedoms?
Yeah, we do, but even that is done in a much milder way. This is why there it says, you know, being free from hell beings, hunger. But there's no teachings on that, really, you know. So when I teach on this, and this is why we're sending out this to the beginner's course that we do in Ramat HaShaon and in Jerusalem, I said, I was wondering whether I should change it, and then I decided no. But I will explain that what it means. It means that, you know, being born as a hell being is like you're constantly overwhelmed with excruciating pain or extreme heat or extreme cold. That there is, you don't have any space to meditate on your mind, especially not on Buddha nature, because it's nowhere to be seen. Okay? So that's hell beings, hell states. If you think of Iraq at the moment, you know, if you're a British person and you're caught by these people who are just black, this is hell realm. Well, we don't need to give them names. This is hell realm because you're not safe anywhere. Not even for a second you're safe if you are in such a situation. So there's this fear, you know. Or if you are a person who has a paranoia, clinical paranoia, and you're in a mental asylum, same thing. You don't feel safe, not even for a second, even though the outside conditions would be safe because you're in a clinic, but your mind is producing a hell state. Everybody wants to kill me. Yeah? Everybody is my enemy. And then you start fighting, and then you start to create negative karma. So when we talk about the hell realms, you know, it is not a state where you just sit and wait for your negative karma to ripen and, you know, people bash you. You also defend yourself. So you create more negative karma. That's the problem about being attacked, you know. That one starts to defend oneself. And sometimes one even thinks it's justified to kill the other because he wants to kill me. That's the worldly view, right? He started it. So therefore, I think you know this mantra. They started it. Yeah, that's it. You know, there is no start to this whole thing. There can be stop.
But children are born with this. He started it.
Hmm?
Little babies, yeah, are born with it.
Exactly. And the world is actually, you know, fortifying that view. If he started it, you have a right to bash the person, you know. And sometimes we even have that view ourselves. If I harm somebody, I give him the permission somehow to harm me back. Somehow, you know, I'm not talking about killing, I'm more talking about being unpleasant with me, okay? If I'm very unpleasant with somebody who was okay with me, but then they start to turn against me also, I somehow understand that I started it, and I somehow allow them to be unpleasant with me because I understand, which is actually a good thing, because then it will stop, because I'm not going to retaliate. It's not good for the other person because, you see, even as a victim, one has this feeling that one is allowed to hit back. But how long are you the victim? How many times can you hit back? And how long do I allow, as the aggressor, the victim to hit me? How many times? It's questionable. One time, two times, three times? Before I start to get angry, I also and say, hey, now that's enough.
The nice point is that I understand that I created the cause. Even if not today or in this life.
Yeah.
So gradually, I learn to understand that whatever happens to me,
yeah,
if I see it, that I hit someone, he hits me back, then it's vivid.
Right.
But if I don't hit him, I begin to understand that I did it previously.
Exactly.
So
exactly. Oh, yeah, it's a very good understanding. It's the understanding of karma, you know. It makes a stop. So hell realms, hungry ghosts, it's like you are in a constant... I yell at you, it's so tired that you have to go down there. Maybe sit on a chair if you can't sit on the floor. Okay, because it's not a very inspiring posture that you have there. But if you have problems with your back, it's totally okay to sit on a chair. Okay? Because also it's much easier to hear and much easier to listen when we accustom ourselves to sit in a proper way, you know. The mind really pulls along with it. It gets more inspired, it's more awake, like that. I let you go to sleep earlier tonight and maybe also in the breaks.
If you smoke cigarettes, that's why.
In the breaks, I also smoked. It's okay. One can't stop, actually. It's so great. You know, you don't have to think every time you get out of the house. Do I have the cigarettes? Do I have the lighter? You know, always, I used to wear jeans and always, it was always in my back pocket. And I smoked a lot. I smoked about 2 packets a day. She'd done. So,
She'd done?
Mm. So they're very strong and they really stink. So there you go. One can stop and one can recover, I think, also. So, but the earlier you stop, better. So talk to people who stopped, you know. Talk to people who stopped so that you can... Yeah, there you go. Look at how many.
I stopped in a retreat in the 10 days introduction to Buddhism.
There you go.
For 10 days, and then when I went out, I didn't feel
Then you think, why continue now? Yeah, right, like this. So sometimes it works. Sometimes it's just the right moment. Sometimes it doesn't. I think what is very good, this is Yael, for example, Yael Shalev. She was a very heavy smoker. So she had this very special way of doing it, you know, by, I think, postponing it, thinking, this cigarette, I'm not going to smoke. I'll smoke the next one. But not this one.
She also used a very good book, which we
exactly
recommend me to buy for me, and I forgot the name. I'll get the name. Mm. I'll buy 2. One from my for Nomi and one from you. Want one?
Yeah.
Do you want to start?
Yeah.
I'll buy one.
So there you go. So hungry ghost. Like this is it. It's, you know, needing the cigarette is the mind of a hungry ghost, for example. Like you can't concentrate, you know, you kind of, your mind is on what you want, what you need, and you never find any satisfaction, ever, you know. And it's hunger, thirst, going around and not finding everything. So your whole effort is finding what you need, and, you know, this is how you spend your day. Animals, they say animals, the problem with animals is, one thing is, you know, when we think about animals, we think about pets. Oh, it's not so bad to be born as a pet. Somebody, I can't remember where it was, maybe in Ramat HaSharon, said, oh, I want to be a cow in Switzerland. You know, they have, how do you call where the milk is? Udders, how do you call these things?
Udder.
Where the milk is. They give 30 liters of milk every day. They have this thing between the legs that is almost bursting. Every day, every day, every day, every day. Of course they live in beautiful pastures. But you think they care that they see the mountains and they see the lakes and they see that they have green grass?
Yeah, if they knew how it is to grow up in a small...
But they don't. So you think I should bring them here and see the conditions of the Israeli cows? Then they go, oh yeah, wow, we should be very happy.
Israeli cows give 150 liters a day.
Or maybe the Swiss have cows by now also more, I don't know. But it's, if I see them, you know, with this blown up thing between the legs that I think it could be my breast, I go like, oh my gosh, you know. So anyway, but in general they talk about animals that are out in nature, that are prosecuted but not by humans, or, you know, but are constantly afraid of others. Right? There's very few lions, but even the lions, when they get old, they get attacked by smaller animals like hyenas and animals like this, you know. So, but the problem in the animal realm is that you're only interested in comfort. You're not interested in anything else. And you cannot endure short-term hardships because, you know, you cannot endure them happily because, you know, the long-term benefit is bigger than the hardship or the pain. So this is basically the mind of an animal, quite dull, okay? They're not very intelligent, like, you know, compared to humans. So again, if I say that in a beginner's course, at least half of the people get angry. How can you talk about this, about animals? You know, it's not to say that animals are bad or anything like this. It's just to say that you don't want to aim to go to an animal state. That's all. But for them, the whole course is finished when they hear this. So actually, I got told by Rinpoche not to talk about these, not to go into them, like it says in the Lam Rim, because he said, because one thing, they don't believe it anyway. Hell, realms, hungry ghosts, they don't believe it. So what's the point of trying to talk about this? And then if you don't stop, they'll start throwing stones at you, he said. And then he said, but you should concentrate on the suffering of humans so that they see it. But because this is Buddhism A to Z, this is why I mention it, because this is the lowest form of taking refuge, the fear of being born in the lower states. And karma comes after, the topic of karma comes after taking refuge, like explaining karma. Okay? Because why? We take refuge and we start to see that there is somebody who has liberated himself. So therefore, I can trust this person when I listen to the teachings of karma, because we don't know. I don't feel all these, you know, oceans and oceans and oceans of karmic imprints, negative karmic imprints on my mind. I don't really feel it when I create a slight karmic imprint. Sometimes even I create a big karmic imprint, I feel a bad conscience for a little while, then it disappears. But I haven't done anything with the imprint. Yeah. So basically, when we think about impermanence and death, and we look at our daily life, because there is this topic in impermanence and death, in the first one, death is certain, because, you know, these three underheadings, because, you remember, or shall I tell you? How do you support that statement that death is certain? You need to give your mind some reasons that it is certain. Because everybody until now has died. So why would I think I don't die? There's one. There's always three, yeah? What's the next one?
The time of death is not known.
No, that's the second big one. Well, it's good we're going through these things, actually. It's great.
It's very easy, difficult to maintain the equilibrium.
That's the last, it goes into last. It's good guesses, so keep guessing, it's okay. Lifespan is constantly decreasing, and there's nothing we can add to it. We can't hold it, you know, we can't say, okay, now please stop. They say it's like a sand watch, you know, you turn it around and it just runs out. And the third one is it encourages us, in that category, there's certain, to look at our lives, how we spend our lives, you know, how much positive actions we create, how much negative actions we create, how much effort we spend by working for not to be born in the lower states or liberation or full enlightenment, and how much time we spend actually creating causes for samsara, and not just for samsara like now as human beings, but for the lower states. And then to make a conscious decision, I have to put more effort into looking after my daily actions, right? Do you see what I mean? The point of this. Already there you hear, you know, or you're encouraged in looking at your daily life. And the thing about the Lam Rim is, of course, first, this is why we do the introduction courses pretty shallow. We're not going into details, because one needs to know the whole thing in a very, you know, overlooking way. Like, for example, you go to a restaurant and you just run through the whole menu first. And then you start to look at the specific things. Okay, so starting with the Lam Rim, you already know a little bit about karma. I don't know it in detail, maybe, but you already know something. You definitely know about Four Noble Truths when you start with Lam Rim. It's actually quite a shame. You see, the Lam Rim is the perfect practice book that will lead you to liberation. That's why the title is Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand, right? By Pabonka Rinpoche. Very often people think, oh, Lamrim, you know, again, this old Lamrim, always the same thing, it's for beginners. It's not for beginners. It's for people who want to practice, for people who understand the Four Noble Truths, which I think we already did, no, in this A to Z, didn't we? The Four Noble Truths. You worked with this quite a lot. So you know about dukkha and the causes for dukkha. So you know about karma. Yeah? You know about what creates karma. You know about negative emotions. Right? So there one is encouraged to look at your daily life. Then the next one is like the time of death, totally uncertain. So what is the three things that are... The tree heading. No, don't look. Try to. Yeah, you got it there. It's okay. You can give it to me because I don't have it here. But no, it's okay. I think I remember. It's okay, Nifsim. I think I remember. It's all right. I do remember. It's not just I think. I do remember. But try to remember yourself. You know, this is always good. It helps the mind when we have to search for it. When you just read it, then. Actually, maybe before every A to Z weekend, we should make an exam or something with questions like this, because then you have more. Then you prepare also, yeah. Because this is what the lamas do, you know. When they teach on Lamrim, they always start from the beginning, dang dang dang, until they are at the new topic. We just want to have the new topic. I know the other.
Is there similar to the first
week? Not really.
No.
The time of yeah. Well, our lifespan is.
We can die every day.
Our lifespan, yeah, that's the head. Yeah. The time of death is uncertain, okay?
No, why?
Because our lifespans are not fixed. They're not fixed. You know, the lifespan of your Visa card is fixed, which is a good thing. Because then you use it. No, I mean, if I know that my Visa card is going to expire next week, and I know I have to buy a plane ticket, I do it today. And I'm not waiting until next week because the new one hasn't come yet or something like that. Or, you know, you have these abonnements, how do you say, these cards to go to a gym or something.
Manui.
Or to a swimming place or whatever. Huh?
Manui.
Manui.
Okay.
Wow, sounds like Tahitian. Manui.
So
you have these membership cards. They also expire. Yeah, so maybe you don't want to renew it, but you see the date, and it makes you go. So you see, all these points, they're not to make us depressed. All these points are to help you practice, because the Buddha knew, Atisha knew, who put it together like this, Lama Tsongkhapa knew, who put it together like this, that we're lazy, and that we're having problems in doing these practices. So they give us all these points. They're not to make you feel guilty, but they're to help you on the path. But we have to use them, making our mind familiar with them. So knowing that our lifespan is not fixed, then we start to do something about this. But life is uncertain, the time of death is uncertain. Why? Logic reason, because our lifespan is not fixed. Then the next one, you can die any moment. Why? Because life is very fragile. But they give you very specific reasons. Because one thing is, we're constantly surrounded by things that can kill us. And actually things that are there to protect us from the heat, from the cold, like houses, they can collapse, they can burn. Medicine that is supposed to, you know, save us, they can kill us because the side effects are too strong or we took too much of it. And food can be poisoning and all these kind of things. We're constantly surrounded, you know, traffic, cars, yeah, constantly surrounded by things that can cause our death. That's the outside thing, okay? Inside thing is, body is very fragile. Something that, you know, when we're healthy, we think we're really healthy and strong and we feel very confident and all this. A little thing, and a little headache, a little cold, a little bit tired, is like we become very weak. And something as small as a virus, we can't even see with our own eyes, you know, can enter your body. Ebola. And that's it. And we can't protect ourselves. Okay, masks and suits and all this. But even some of those people catch it. And it's not to make you depressed. It's to encourage you to look at the third point, the third main point. What is the third main point of the death meditation?
How to prepare for death.
Yeah, what will help at the time of death? And then we look at the things that do not help. And then we noticed all the things that will not help, this is what we spend most of our time with while we are alive. Okay? So the first one that will not help is what?
Money.
Our possessions. Things that we cherish and we buy and we work to be able to buy them. And, you know, we try to upkeep them or exchange them when we're bored with them or whatever. And it's true. It can make your life very happy. People who are attached to these things, you know, who have the money to buy a new car every 2 years or something like this, they're very happy with the new car all the time. And because they buy a lot of new cars, then that's it. Jewelry, clothes, shoes, you feel depressed, you're not so well, you go out and buy something. It helps. It really does. Nobody says it doesn't help. But it won't help at the time of death, especially if that's the only refuge, because these things are refuges. A refuge is there to protect you from negative minds, right? So material possessions, while you are alive, can really help. Have you experienced it? Yeah. And then we believe it, and we think, oh, I just keep, you know, these beliefs, there are gut feelings, they're instincts. They're, unfortunately, they're not there. They're not conscious thoughts. Oh, I feel bad, now I go out and buy something. If we would have these thoughts, if we would think like this, you know, we wouldn't do it. Because the intelligence behind it would say, hey, but how many shoes do you already have? Or clothes, or whatever, it doesn't matter what it is, you know, it can be books. Have you read all the books you bought? Have you made a decision, okay, I will not buy any more books until I read all of the ones I bought? Okay. Music, you know, like, well, now you don't need to buy these things anymore. You just download it somewhere. But you download it, and it gets more and more and more, right? So this is what we usually take refuge in, because it works. We're not stupid. We're not taking refuge in something that doesn't work. But it will not work at the time of death. And will definitely doesn't work for liberation. That's the thing. So what are you going to do now, knowing that material possessions are not working at the time of death?
Work on your mind.
How? It's a very good answer, because again, that's one answer. You're not working on your mind, thinking about emptiness, thinking about dependent arising. These are answers that always fit to every question almost.
I will see that taking refuge in it is wrong.
By seeing that it doesn't help. By using, again, you know, giving the mind a logical reason, but hey, okay, best thing is you feel a bit, you go out and buy it. You have to do it, same as with the cigarettes. First you want to smoke. Go and smoke, but then stop. And then you go, now what? It's okay, you know, I can also pour myself. But it's very kind of you, thank you very much, but you don't have to worry while you're sitting there. If I'm finished, and then I will ask you to bring some more. But thank you very much, it's very kind. So then stop, and you just a question, now what? Am I feeling that much better as the promise was when there was desire? Did it give me what I wanted? Did it give me eternal peace? And then it's no, and then you will want the next cigarette, or you want to go, and this is how gradually we start to chip away on these instincts or habits that we have, just, you know, because we don't even question. The desire comes up, and whoosh, and we take it, and we eat it, or we smoke it, or we consume it, or whatever. Yeah, we start to question these gut feelings. Okay, so material possessions don't help. Can they really not help at the time of death? Now, I'm challenging the Lamrim here. Can they really not help at the time of death?
They cannot help.
I think they can.
How can they help?
My dad, he was born very poor. And he was just into making money. And he worked very hard. And he did work very hard. But he worked very hard to leave the money to his children. He was so stingy, he never used it for himself. I had to buy him new pants because otherwise he would have, you know, like now it wouldn't be a problem because everybody walks around with pants that have holes in them. And he died very happily. Whatever you buy, but not an excuse, right? That was his attitude. That was really his attitude. I want to leave my children something. So if you buy something and you buy a very good thing, like a great car, and then you think, wow, if I die, my children can use it. If they're into great cars. If they're not into great cars, then of course. Money, everybody's into money. So you don't have to worry about having a big bank account. Everybody's into money. Now, of course, ultimately, it did not make me and my brother happy everlasting because, you know. But what it allowed me to do is to become a nun with my dad's money because I don't earn anything. So, you know, when I became a nun, nobody knew me. Nobody said, oh, I will support you. And still today, there's lots of monks and nuns who have this fear of financial lack behind them because they have no money and there's maybe not enough confidence that it will come. I didn't have to work on that confidence because I knew I had enough money to last in India. I was calculating to last in India until I would get my pension. In the West, it would not have lasted. But then I came back earlier because my teacher told me to come back, and I also thought health insurance. You know, all the things that you need. I need to live somewhere. But the things just arrange themselves. The group in Bern is paying my health insurance. They offered. Paying for my health insurance. I live in the department where the sentry is. I have to move out when another teacher comes, but it doesn't matter. I have friends. I go live with them. And if I think logically, it's not explainable. I still have the same amount of money like I had when I became a nun. And now it's increasing because I'm on a pension. Karmically, sure, it's explainable, but I hadn't planned it, and it just happened. So.
But I think nobody says, I think, that's what I thought. Nobody says, talking about your father or myself, that it's wrong to collect money.
No.
Certainly not for a good cause. Today or when
exactly.
I die. But the attitude while collecting.
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing. So this is why I'm saying, but when you hear, you know, your material possessions can't help, you go like, okay, then I give everything away and I can die happily. It's definitely not like this. This is just to clear up misconceptions that material possessions can never help. It cannot help you to prevent your death. This is actually what it means, you know. It's not so much that they say, what can help for your next life? It's more from the point of view, what could prevent death? Or, you know, what can help at the time of death? So if, like my friend who has leukemia, if she is in the process of dying and thinks that her daughter, finally, she will have a nice apartment, that will definitely help her to die with a peaceful mind. Okay? Because it's very important to die with a peaceful mind because then you activate a positive imprint. And sometimes if I look at my mom, who also died very peacefully and very happily, she was also born poor and she spent most of my dad's money and she was happy because she wanted to have a comfortable life. She knew many 5-star hotels on this planet, personally. That was the aim. And she was a happy person. So we have to be careful, you know, with these statements. Because we have to, with all the statements, we have to really treat them as the Buddha asks us to treat them, explore it, examine it, you know. If somebody would tell me I have to spend now the rest of my life in 5-star hotels, I would be unhappy. But she was happy, and she died very peacefully. When her money started to run out, because my dad died before her, and it started to run out, we saw her also, she made calculations how long it would last. When she died, there was very little left. But she died before she was penniless. Very peacefully. Consciously almost, you know? Like, even the doctor didn't understand why she was dying. She had pneumonia, and they thought that she could, you know, that was it, that was okay, she would not die. They told me, don't have to hurry coming back, I was still in India. My teacher told me, go home immediately. And then one morning, two days later, my sister-in-law got a telephone, because my brother also had already died, got a telephone from the doctor saying, we don't know what's happening, but this woman is dying. So you better, if you want to see her alive, you better come now. I was still in India. I was on my way to Delhi to take the airplane. And so, actually, I was still in Dharamsala. But I had the date when I would be home. So they went. And my mom just looked at them and said, what are you doing here? I didn't ask you to come. And so they didn't have the courage to say, the doctor told us we are dying. You are dying. This is why we came. So they just said, okay. Do you want to see anybody else? She said, no. And then they said, okay, we come back tomorrow. And she said, no, no need. She died that night. Very peacefully. And you could see, you know, you can feel when you see, because I still then saw the corpse. The dead body. And you feel when you are with the dead body and you feel, she was probably still in the clear light when I came. And when you see the body, you can feel that the death was very painful, because you feel like not wanting to stay in the room. Or you feel like all of a sudden everything opens up. So, not every dead body is totally dead. So they can't hear you and they can't feel you, but they might still be in the clear light. And she still looked quite fresh when I saw her before they cremated her.
How many days you got there before?
I think 3 or something like that. That's just an assumption. But she definitely looked peaceful. She looked in a way that made me feel good. You know? And then, maybe I tell you that also, I started to feel bad about feeling good. And I couldn't figure out what it was. I didn't see it. I said, I don't know why I feel so not good. And couldn't figure out. Then a friend of mine was doing tarot cards. She said, shall we look if the cards maybe give you an explanation? And I was ready to do everything. So, and I used to do tarot also. It's sometimes quite interesting, actually. And so the card guilt came out. Then I thought, why should I be feel guilty? And then I understood I felt guilty of not feeling bad because my mom had died. And then I could let it go. She died such a great... She was in hospital 4 days. 85-year-old. Before, she was staying at home. She was not dement. She was, you know... Didn't need any help, she was living alone. Well, if I can go like this, you know. So both of my parents died very peacefully. So, both of them are very materialistic. So we ourselves have to find out what will make me feel good at the time of death. My mom probably thought, well, you know, I can't go to these places anymore. Also, she's had a little bit of a stroke. And so she'd say, well, you know, there's not so much pleasure anymore because I don't have energy anymore. So her life was pleasure. So like that. So material possessions can't help if you only want them for yourself. If the material possessions are your only refuge, this is where it can't help, you know. The only way you can find some happiness in life is when you are
consuming.
Then it cannot help, because the thought of having to leave them behind is really terrible. Because you go with empty hands. You don't know what you're going to encounter on the other side, but you know it's not going to be a house full of stuff. So that can create a lot of fear and not wanting to let go. Okay, so this is what we have to be careful about. Whatever is yours, whatever you buy, whatever you possess, imagine already now, at one point, somebody else will be using this or will throw it away. And then if there's sadness coming, you know, even your Buddha statues, and you think like this, if your family is not into Buddhism, either they throw it away, especially the pictures, maybe the statues they'll try to sell because they see that they might have some value. But if it's pictures and things like that, they will throw. Without any risk, but just, yeah. So you need to be able to allow them to do this already now. Because a bardo being, a being in the bardo, has clairvoyance, so he might be able to see it. Not when you're still in the body, but when the mind gets out of the body. You can, they say, you still, it has the ability to look backwards a bit. So be careful. So don't take refuge in these things. Just know that everything that you possess, at one point, it will be gone. And somebody else will use it, or somebody else will throw it. What does it make you feel? You know, maybe, but reflect on this. Not just, if you think of this today, yeah, it's okay, because I go and then I don't need anything.
Wouldn't it be right to say, this is a reason for, when you think about death, this is one of the reasons. But wouldn't it be right, when we talk about refuge, use the same point and say, it won't help me, as we said, at the time of death. Even in this life, it's not certain.
Yeah.
I mean, economics change.
Yeah.
My house can be ruined in earthquake or by missile.
Yeah.
It's not safe to take refuge in this.
Yeah. But this is how you discover, because maybe when you have the drastic one about death, then you start to look at it, and then you discover almost by itself that even in this life, it's so meaningless. Unless you give it to somebody else. Yeah? I think this, in this process of thinking about that, that it doesn't help at the time of death, automatically almost, you start to discover, wow, it doesn't even help me now. Yeah? Next one that won't help, that we take refuge in, is what?
Friends and family.
Friends and family. First thing, telephone, you know. I don't feel well, either text or WhatsApp or Hangout or I don't know what else is there. And you try to contact them.
Facebook.
Yeah, this joke about Facebook. He had like 2,000 friends and there's only the two of us at his funeral. Only two turned up at the funeral and said, but on the Facebook he's got 2,000 friends, you know. So by the way, I'm not on the Facebook anymore because I got too many messages with articles which were very interesting, but I just did not have time to read them. So I would save them and save them and save them, then get all tense wanting to read them, and well, it just accumulated and then I quit. Okay. But Facebook also can have good sides because at one point also I found out somebody had died. You know, because somebody knew the password and put on the Facebook account that she had died. And I think even with Yasmin, also here, maybe not many of you knew her, I found out that she had died. She was up from up north. I knew her from India. Yasmin.
Not ours, no. She's very much alive.
Okay, so she didn't come off. She did a few retreats. She had reddish hair, very pretty lady.
What?
I can't remember. Huh? From somewhere, from near Yodfat, somewhere. Liora Price knows her really well. So anyway, and it's quite a number of years already that she has died. She had cancer and then died. So like this, so friends and family. So how friends and family, one looks at this, you know, not to take refuge in them, to see, at one point I have to go alone. So you start already now to do what, Nisim? When you're not so well. You said it before. To work with your mind alone when you're not so well.
But it's right for all that question.
Huh? What's that?
That's right for all the questions.
Yeah, but for that one also.
Yeah.
We start, so it doesn't mean we don't use it because it's right for all the questions, right? We start to look refuge. You know, refuge means I feel protected, I feel safe, I calm down. That's what refuge means. You become a refugee when you know that if I stay where I am, is not safe, and then you run away. And you use your intelligence by, you know, I mean, if you're in Israel, you're not going to run to Iraq. Or if I'm in Switzerland and my neighbor is not wanting me to be there, I'm not going to look for a Dharma center in Iraq, because we are looking for a new place.
Yeah.
In Israel, okay. Maybe not also.
New place.
I'm not sure, anyway.
Apartment in Bern.
Huh?
Different apartment in Bern.
Exactly. So we're looking for one, but you know, Switzerland is Switzerland. So we need a permit. And where people live, you cannot do religious activities. It has to be in an industrial area. If it's in an industrial area, you're not allowed to make an apartment there or a room in that, whatever it is. So it's like, and we want to make it legal. It's not easy to make things legal, by the way.
In the Gratacre Center in Paris, they bought a shop, a big place for shopping.
But you're not allowed to live there. That's what you said.
Nobody lives there, I think. But it's
yeah, but we need something. We can't. We don't have the financial means to then when there's for the teachers to buy an apartment or to rent an apartment from them separate. Because now it's perfect, you know, it's apartment and center. So that's what
so
I mean.
Why do you want to leave?
Huh?
Neighbor.
Because of the neighbor. Because of the neighbor and because of these restrictions that we have, because it's difficult. Anyway, friends and families will not be able to help. And what it encourages us especially to clear up your problems you have with friends and family. That at least from your own side, to forgive them if they have harmed you, to not wish them bad, to to think if I meet them again in another life, maybe a happier... And I'm talking about problematic situations, you know? To think that if I meet them again in another life, maybe a happier relationship. Because sometimes it's not even you, you know? I hear so many stories about families. Also in Switzerland. Just now something quite big is happening there, you know? In heritage. Best is you don't leave any money and no apartments, whatever, to your children. Because there, so many families, I don't know how it is here, but so many court cases over inheritance of people. It's so stupid, you know? And everybody feels that the other one is getting more. Or too much. He's like, yeah? It's crazy. So, you know, my mom leaving so little money that we could just distribute like this, that was it. Her few possessions we gave to the thrift store, and that was it, finished. You know, nobody wanted it. The whole thing was settled in half a day. And no fighting. And you know what I'm wondering, and I hope, because now I know, but no, I don't have any parents anymore who can leave me money. But if ever anybody leaves me $1 million, I will be able to share it. But because I've worked with this, because the thought came, because I distributed the money to more people than were allowed to have the money. And in equal parts, you know? I mean, allowed, that by law, yeah? I would have gotten half, and my nieces would have gotten the other half. But we divided it into four, so that my sister-in-law also could have a part, because I thought, well, you know, that's the family that is left, so let's divided, but she would have been left with nothing. I thought that was not right. Anyway, and I was thinking, if my mom would have left me $1 million, would have given my sister-in-law 250,000 Swiss francs. I hope so. But I'm not sure. Now I'm sure I would, because I had to really decide it while I didn't have it. You see what I mean? Yeah. Because when you have it, it's kind of, oh, what, do you think? No, maybe I give her 100,000 or something like that, you know. To see that actually the more money there is, the more difficult it is to give it away. That's a funny thing, you know? So, like that. So, very important is to learn not only to take refuge in them for help, because we have to go alone, we cannot take them with us. Yeah. So then, in what way could they help? You know, they also, same as with material possessions, it's not that they cannot help at all. They cannot help to prevent you dying, that's for sure, because you have to go. For them.
No, they can pray for you.
They can make prayer. No, I'm more talking about us. He was still taking, where do we take refuge?
I thought you were talking about the relatives.
Yeah,
they cannot,
I am.
They cannot help us.
I thought it's
okay.
Good time
they, yeah,
for me
it's a good thought.
Die.
They can make
I
prayers.
It's a good time for me to die because there are people who will pray for me.
Okay. For example, yeah, exactly. People will make practices.
But sometimes.
What if your family is like traditionally Jewish and think, wow, now she's dead?
That's why we have a sangha.
Now she is dead. Wait, now she is dead. Now we'll give her a Jewish funeral.
No,
and we pray for her in this. You better, yeah, this is what I mean, you know, these are all things to think about. So talk about with your family like this and say, look, I know that you are, you know, think I'm going to hell because I'm a Buddhist, but I don't think so. So please, you know, my last wish would be, and write it down. You know, I have
because
in my...
Because his sister can tell me no, we have to have, and he's against...
There you go. Yeah.
I've been reading in one of Thich Nhat Hanh's books about staying or sitting by a person who is going to die, and he called it water the seeds of happiness.
Yeah.
If you have people that are close to you, family
right.
and friends, even
right.
though they don't pray for you, and I saw it when my mother died in the hospital, and she was not alone in the room, and I saw... We were with her, but we were very few and very frightened. And we couldn't really help her through her last minutes. But I saw another lady, she was just lying next to my mother, and I saw her friends and her family watering the seeds of happiness and sharing with her beautiful events that they had.
Exactly. That's what I wanted to hear. They can help us, not so much when they tell us, because we don't know if they're going to tell us, but when we remember the good things we've done to them. So you need to, again, it's the same as with the material possessions. You need to try this out in this life already. Thinking that, you know, when you're leaving them, for example, just to go abroad or just to go away for a while, and then you feel sad. How am I going to work with this sadness? Because actually thinking about the good things, it might even make you more attached. So again, you know, all this is not certain. These are things, these are methods that if we try them out now, we see if they work or not. But definitely, if you have a thought of how, or even, you know, the good things they've done to you and the good things you've done to them. The best for you to relax and have a peaceful and quiet mind is the good things you've done for them. Then I think not so much attachment is, and to maybe think also to think about them instead of, oh, I'm dying, to think about them and think, may they not suffer too much from my death. May they continue to have a happy life. May they forget me very quickly. And to look what that kind of thought provokes in your mind. And then to try it out, you know, or to imagine you're abroad somewhere, 6 months or something like that, after 2 weeks, you phone, you're concerned how they are, you're sure they miss you, and then they say, oh no, we're having a great time, good thing you went, because we don't miss you at all. How will you react to that? Of course, they will never say it, but they might actually mean it.
But if they say you're all right, they're all right and they're happy, it's nice. If they say, we are very glad you've gone, that's
what I mean.
That's a bit embarrassing.
That's what I mean. What they won't say, you're happy you're gone, but they say, don't worry, we don't miss you.
It's very nice. I'm glad that my children...
Good.
I'm very glad that my children went from the nest and
yeah.
they're happy.
Okay, good.
And they don't miss you. and you cannot come to see us because we are getting along very
well. When I call them and they don't answer and they don't give me a contact, I'm a bit furious.
Exactly. That's what I mean. So, you know, see, this is where the really looking deeply goes in. And where to be honest with ourselves goes in. What if they say, you don't have to call again, we don't miss you, we're okay. Do we really feel happy? You know? To be able to really make that genuine wish, may they be able to continue to live without me. If it's your partner, and you're to think, may my partner find somebody else, that they're even happier with this other person than with me. You know? And especially I've been saying that to young mothers who are dying because they leave small children behind. But, you know, very, very carefully going there. Because the thought that another woman will come along and look after them just as well as they did is very painful. So you have to prepare the person for that thought in a very, very careful way that they're able to think that thought. Because then they are okay. Their last act of love, to wish for this other person to appear to look after the children. So while you're not dying, you think, of course I have a thought like this because I love my children. But when you really know that you have to go and you're not coming back, it's very difficult to have these thoughts. So this is what I mean, what I'm saying. Don't think that this is easy. To leave your friends and families behind, because they are our refuge in daily life. But it collapses, that refuge collapses at the time of death. The third one that we take refuge in. The third one?
The other two were not to take refuge in.
Yeah, but that's what we do take refuge in now, as we're still alive, and that won't help. Okay, maybe it should have been more clear. The third thing that we take refuge in, meaning that we're looking for protection, we're looking for happiness. This is taking refuge, is looking for happiness, or looking for happiness we already have. For that, you don't need to take refuge. But trying to find that happiness, yeah, is it a safe place to take refuge? So what's the third thing that, while we're still alive, we take refuge in? The body. We do something nice with the body. We listen to some nice music. We eat some good food. We go for a swim. Somebody said at one point, I don't need all this. My refuge is dancing. I don't feel good. I go dancing. I said, yeah, great, but you know, at the time of death, I don't know if you're capable to dance. You see, what these kind of teachings, what is encouraging us is look for a refuge that you have access to at the time of death. And that can only be in your mind. Definitely not in your body. And if we look at the body, you know, we don't, because, you see, we recognize attachment clearly when there's the pain of separation, of material possessions, or of friends, family, like that, when there's pain. Then we see that we are attached. If there's no pain, of course, then there's no attachment. It doesn't mean that you should not enjoy the objects. It just means that I have to be careful because separation will come at one point. But because we're never separated from this body, we don't feel the attachment to it. And believe it or not, this is the thing that we are most attached to. Very often, even more attached than to our children. Because so many thoughts about keeping it healthy, clean, well, you know, full of energy, go into it. Not just the thoughts. The thoughts then lead to action. I mean, how much money have we spent on this body already? How much care? Huh? How much? What?
A lot.
A lot. And what does the body do at the time of death? He says, you, I'm tired, get out, bye. I give up. And it chucks you out, it chucks the mind out. You know, the body loses the strength to be a vessel for the mind at the time of death. Whether you want or not, you have to leave it. And the body, what will happen to the body? The thing that you cherished so much, what will happen to it?
Decay.
It will either decay, or, well, not in this country, but in Europe, definitely most of the people, it will be burned. All that will remain is few bones and your metal things, and if Botox, no, the Botox also burns. You know, with the Botox for the breasts, right? As a really good, because in Tahiti, believe it or not, even 30-year-old women have Botoxed breasts. Because in Tahiti, they're already...
It's a silicon glass, and the Botox is...
Okay, silicon, yeah, right. It's for the lips and for all these things.
Yeah, it makes the muscle...
Yeah, I don't understand so much about these things anyway, so... But silicon... So it's like silicon bags that you put in here. So they say, you know, if our culture or our civilization dies, and then there's new people coming, maybe from a different planet, and they see our burial sites, because they also bury. They bury the people in their grave in their garden. The dead people stay at home. Yeah, it's quite nice. And so they say, well, they see these graves and they see the skeletons and they see these two plastic bags hanging here. They will go like, what on earth is this?
Maybe you can recycle them.
Because it doesn't decay, isn't it? No, they don't. Oh, they don't. They recycle the metal in Switzerland. They pull it out of the ashes. And they, of course, there was this big question, what about gold teeth? Whom do they belong to?
The earth, where it came from.
That's what you say, because you don't have a father or mother who had a mouth full of gold teeth that you could sell the gold.
Then it belongs to me first.
Big question. No, it's a big question in Switzerland. Whom does it belong to? So they actually ask the families what they want to do, if they want to pull it out. So there's special machines like who kind of pull them out. And so most of the family actually, that's quite nice. Say it can go with the ashes. It can go with the ashes.
It burns with the fire?
It doesn't really burn, that's the thing.
It melts,
but it doesn't burn. You can get it out. Yeah. Because also the bones don't burn. I didn't know all these things. There was a thing on TV. So the bones don't burn, so they have to go through, they put it through a mill. And then with the mill, there's this special thing where the gold or the heavy stuff falls in.
So when you give the ashes, they give the ashes without the bones?
There's little pieces of bones. And it takes a long time for them to go, because I went to help somebody scatter ashes and do some rituals. And she said, well, you know, he wanted to be buried in the garden. So a year later, these bits of bones are still there. So because the rain doesn't really hit it because it's under a tree. It takes a long time. So it's just little, you know, like when you paint and then you go like this, is little things like this, because it goes through a mill. Otherwise, you would have the pieces of bone. I didn't know all that. But you see the pieces of bone.
In India,
it's not just ashes.
In India, they don't they?
Yeah, maybe they burn. I don't know what they do in India. Anyway, it doesn't really matter so much. I don't know what they do in India with the bones. But maybe they also smash. I think they also smash them. But not sure. I'm not sure. So, this body, you know, I had the ashes of my mom, I had with me for some time, and then I would put it in holy places. I don't know if it helps, but it definitely doesn't harm. And also in places that I knew she would like. So some of the ashes of my mom are in Inbar, where you look out into the valley, because I knew she would like that view. Just as a, you know, of course she doesn't see it and all that. I mean, I'm not crazy. But it's made me, one thing is it, looking at the ashes, every time I said thank you to my mother for giving me this body, wanting to put the ashes somewhere where I knew she would like it, because I had a difficult relationship with my mom. My heart would open because I was concerned about her, where she is now. And also I would think, you, one day my body will be like this. So it's very helpful. So try to work with the attachment that we have to the body that we don't feel now. So that you say, okay, I'm not my body. So for so many people, dying is very difficult because they think they are their body. And they think now it's finished. You know? And they have problems kind of separating from it. Okay? So these are the things that we usually take refuge in, and what And what do we need the refuge for? We need the refuge for, at this point in the Lamrim, to protect us from the lower states. Now, knowing about karma, what will protect us from the lower states? Because do you think you have karmic imprints to be reborn in the lower states? Or, okay, if you can't relate to the lower states as a, you know, world in a different dimension, it's fine with me, okay? But lower states meaning a state where you, you know, constantly filled with excruciating pain. I mean, there's people who are born with skin that is so sensitive that, you know, they have to cover it all the time and they have to, you know, it's to certain degrees, but some is really, really, really bad. It's blisters and it's, you know, and they're in constant pain. Some people are born with deformed body or in constant pain. It's not excruciating because they're not screaming all the time, but would you like to have such an existence? You know, some people, if I looked at, you know, I always remember this visit that we had from these people from where Reut is living. I was surprised at how happy they are. You know, like one had a back like this and legs that were that short and just dangling, totally useless, but she had developed her arms and she was abandoned, wasn't she? She was thrown out by the family or something like this. We had an afternoon once in Tuvalu with them. I was so surprised at their spontaneous happiness. Because why? She has no attachment to her bad body whatsoever, I think. You know? But still, you know, you can say, okay, there are people who are very happy with such terrible bodies, but do you have a guarantee that you will be happy with such a body? So this is why we try to not to go there, you know? Makes sense? We try to have a body that is healthy because it's easier. The life is easier with a healthy body. You can also do much more harm with a healthy body, that's true. But if you take refuge and you start to live according to refuge, which what we'll do tomorrow, yeah, we finished 2 minutes, which what refuge is telling us, then we don't have to be so afraid of death. And we will not go to the lower states. Not because we don't have negative imprints on the mind, okay? Like the lowest form of refuge at the time of death is the fear, you know, take refuge because you don't want to the lower states. So you have something to anchor your mind on at the time of death, thinking about your practice. And then, of course, if you don't practice, what will happen? You had all these wonderful intellectual teachings, but you never even tried to put them into action. What will happen then when you think about the Dharma?
Regret.
Guilt. Mm-hmm. Regret. Oh, I should have, and why didn't I? And so whenever, again, in this life, this comes up, let go. It doesn't make you practice guilt. Intelligence, wisdom, compassion for yourself. You know, encouraging yourself. Like we encourage little children that have to do something difficult. You know, you say, come on, this will be good for you. Things like that. Okay? So if you're able to visualize, this is why we should learn to visualize when we take refuge. Not just I take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha until enlightenment, and the mind is, I don't know where. Because when you, then it's not just a word. Then you engage in seeing the Buddha. You train the mind to see the Buddha. And at the time of death, you will remember that. So then a positive imprint will be activated. You will be reborn in a place where you can continue with the practices. If you remember bodhicitta, you know, your heart totally opens, then of course, you know, may I be reborn in a place where I can be, where I can continue to be of benefit to others. There's no way you will have a negative imprint ripening. You will still take them with you, the negative imprints, but then again you have the chance to purify them. But if we are not afraid of being reborn in the lower states, we will not do these trainings. And these trainings, of course, we can do them here in the group, but doing them here in the group is only for you to learn them. And then they have to be integrated in your daily life. It doesn't. And the more you use to visualize Shakyamuni Buddha, and when you take refuge, to do it properly, you know, your mom at your left side, your father at your right side, the people you don't like are in front of you, people you dislike behind you, all the sentient beings around you, it comes very quickly when you're used to do that, but we forget, isn't it? So then it's good to be reminded again and again and again and again. This is actually how one takes refuge. And then when you take refuge, this is why you put everybody around you, not just for myself, but in order to benefit all sentient beings. Okay? So we didn't take refuge yet, because I thought, I will prepare you for that first. So this is what was the talk this morning. Yeah. And it's really good in your daily life. Not even thinking about death, but to see when my mind is having a problem, where does it go? And this is the meditation that will do. And you don't need to tell anybody, but you know, this whole thing of sharing is really powerful. This is why then we have discussion groups on these things, you know, that you tell each other where your mind goes when there's a problem. So then there is no guilt, there's no fear of somebody finding out, because the best antidote for guilt is telling somebody. But we have to, it's good that the group is so small and we know each other, because when we start doing discussion groups like this, there needs to be an accord that none of this is going out, ever, with names. It's quite a big responsibility that we have when somebody is telling us problems or whatever. And one needs to make a promise to oneself, I will never ever use it to make fun of the person or to tell somebody, to gossip about it, like that. Because the Sangha, as a jewel, or as a part of refuge, if you can't trust it, it's useless. And you have the responsibility as a Sangha member that people can trust you. You know, we're always kind of expecting others that we should be able to trust them and they have to do everything I want them to do. No. Again, it's for us. Can people trust me? Or am I going to tell somebody else what I just, you know, what somebody else just said? It's for us to check. And then we can die with a good feeling about ourselves. Then a positive imprint will ripen. Is that clear? Okay. So now we make a break. Is it?
No.
No. Okay. Now we have 15 minutes break.
Why not break? You need a break.
No, we need to have a break. I don't know. I made the schedule. I forgot the break here. I'm sorry.